Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. President Obama is chiding Congress for not acting on his slimmed-down plan to spur economic growth in Wyoming and elsewhere. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that election year politicking is expected to derail this latest effort to get the economy moving.
This week, the president laid out a to-do list for Congress. He's asking lawmakers to help him lower interest rates on mortgages for millions of homeowners struggling with their payments in the midst of this sluggish economy. And he wants to entice U.S. companies with holdings overseas to invest that money here at home. In a speech in Albany, New York, the president urged Congress to pass these and three other components of the Jobs Act he introduced earlier in the year.
Just saying no to ideas that we know will help our economy isn't an option. There's too much at stake. We've all got to pull in the same direction. So even if Republicans are still saying no to some of the bigger proposals we made in the Jobs Act, there are some additional ideas that could help people get to work right now and that they haven't said no to yet, so I'm hoping they say yes.
Wyoming's three Republican members of Congress are dubious of the president's charge, though. A central plank in the administration's new legislative push is to renew a series of tax breaks that have helped Wyoming's renewable energy industry get off the ground. Senior Senator Mike Enzi says Democratic leaders aren't letting senators debate and tweak legislation. He says the president is also saying, take it or leave it.
So if he's got a bunch of energy bills that he's designed the same way, they're designed to fail. They're designed to make Republicans look bad, and that's not the role a president ought to play. But this one is playing that game every day.
Enzi says Democrats are not allowing issues to be fully debated in committee. As for the tax credits for energy firms, Enzi says he's not opposed to the idea, but he wants Congress to debate them.
Yes, it's a good policy for the nation, but you got to look at the details on it. I have no idea what the details are. And the committees that are familiar with it ought to be looking at the details on it. But they're not sending anything to committees these days. They're just designed to show that Congress can't get anything done. And that's why they can't, because it doesn't go to committee where bipartisan work can be done.
Republican Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis is skeptical for a different reason. She says she discusses the renewable tax credits with Wyoming energy firms often, so she knows the industry currently depends on them.
Well, we have a lot of renewables in Wyoming, particularly wind energy. So they are important to some of our wind energy businesses.
But Lummis says she thinks it's time for Congress to rethink how the government incentivizes energy firms. This gets a little technical, but stick with me. Lummis wants to switch from tax credits to tax deductions. Currently, these energy firms get tax credits, which means they get a hefty lump sum from the government annually based on the amount of energy they produce. Lummis wants Congress to switch to tax deductions, which would mean companies would get a smaller refund that would probably be based on a percentage of their energy output.
It's going to have a big difference in the actual tax benefit associated. However, having it be a deduction rather than a credit will begin to wean some of these industries off credits that we can no longer afford.
Environmentalists say tax credits have helped make the wind industry competitive. They also point to the subsidies the oil and gas industry enjoys and say these tax credits are leveling the playing field and helping clean America's air. Courtney Abrams is the federal clean energy advocate for Environment America. She says the data speaks for itself.
The price of wind has dropped 90% since 1980 with support of things like the production tax credit, and it's creating jobs here in the United States. So 60% of a wind turbine's value is now produced in the United States, up from 25% before 2005.
Besides energy, the president's plan would provide tax credits to small businesses who hire new employees. And the House has already acted on a bill to ease the tax burden on small firms. But Republicans still don't seem to be on board with the president. That has Democrats, such as Virginia Congressman Jim Moran, accusing the GOP of trying to play politics with the economy.
Even if it was something that the House majority had planned to do, the fact that the president asked them to do it, they wouldn't do it. The principal objective of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives is to defy and defeat the president of the United States.
The partisan tit-for-tat is nothing new, and analysts expect the gridlock to persist through November's elections. That means the president and House Republicans are both likely to continue to see their agendas blunted. Voters will then be left to decipher which party is to blame for the sluggish economy. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Thank you.
earlier this year, the Wyoming legislature set aside some $30 million in matching money to help pay for a major upgrade in UW's College of Engineering. With an anticipated cost of nearly $100 million, it would be UW's most expensive building project. The last major addition to the college occurred in 1980. Right now, labs are too small, classrooms are crowded, and the front portion of the building has a distinct 1920s flavor. As Bob Beck reports, at a time when other building projects were occurring on campus, the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee said skipping the College of Engineering would have been a crime.
Senator Phil Nicholas has been a member of the Appropriations Committee during most of Wyoming's boom years. During that time, he saw support for a number of building projects. This year, he oversaw planning for future budget cuts. But before those occur, Nicholas wanted one last shot at getting what could be the last round of funding for a project he felt had been overlooked, the College of Engineering.
My conclusion was that it would be a sad thing for the state of Wyoming to go through this second boom, the first boom being the 80s, and not come out with an extraordinarily strong, robust College of Engineering.
Nicholas says a number of Wyoming economic development efforts have depended on the college in the past, and he believes that an enhanced college would do even more.
And when I began to pitch that to my colleagues, I realized there was great support.
Nicholas says Wyoming has spent a lot of money to recruit firms to come to the state. He believes that this project will lead to UW graduates creating a number of high-tech jobs. Nicholas says the College of Engineering already has a track record.
It's pretty remarkable. You look at Trihydro here. You look at a variety of engineering firms that are just straight engineering. A lot of innovation, a lot of information technology jobs. And those are where we're seeing most of our growth. And frankly, most of it's coming out of the College of Engineering.
UW Provost Myron Allen is excited about the possibilities.
It's already a fine College of Engineering, and it's responsible for the majority of the spin-offs and startup companies in southeast Wyoming. But having a stronger College of Engineering and Applied Science would really help us to attract even more high-tech firms and other types of industries to the area.
Allen says enhancing the college has been needed for a while, and it will have an impact.
We've actually been able to attract really good faculty members, but we've had to focus more recently on faculty members in areas that don't require large laboratories because we simply don't have the laboratory space.
Allen says that's hindered what research could be done, and he says that enhancing the labs will certainly help students be better prepared. But few are more excited about the prospects than College of Engineering Dean Rob Edema. He says he came to Wyoming because of the reputation of the college, but he says they have some key needs.
We have foreseeable growth in enrollment, so we need to increase capacity for more students. We lack capacity for research labs and space, space for graduate students and so on. And thirdly, just the sense of the professional ambience of the college is a bit dated.
Dated might be an understatement. The college was constructed in the 1920s. A west wing was added in 1960, and the modern part of the facility was built over 30 years ago. Despite all of this, Forbes magazine listed the college as one of the nation's best buys, and the atmospheric science program has long been recognized as one of the top programs in the country. But if they can build better research facilities, Edema says there's even more they can do.
We'll be able to do more innovative research in engineering and computer science and atmospheric science. And, you know, most of this country's technology innovation occurs at a university. Wyoming shouldn't be second to anybody in that regard, I think.
Edema says the goal is to grow in rankings and stature. So as they're busy discussing what the building will look like, he stresses that all the department heads are looking at developing the best program they can.
Looking at where we have strategic advantages that we can build and make more of, how we can strengthen the faculty and staff, numbers and talent here. So what we're underway with is not just a building program. I characterize it as a program building program.
Edema says they're also looking at how these programs and their graduates can advance Wyoming's economic growth. This plan will be presented to the legislature and a timeline will be agreed upon. But there is one more thing they'll have to do, and that's to find donors. While the legislature provided planning money and has set aside $30 million, This is expected to be a $100 million effort, so UW has money to raise. But Senator Nicholas says if they can make the case that Wyoming students will be trained to work in-state and that economic development can be enhanced, he believes that will be a strong selling point, and he hints that there could also be some additional legislative dollars available as well. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, we'll discuss Casper's anti-smoking ordinance and the scanning of dinosaur bones and fossils. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. The city of Casper is considering a ban on smoking in all public places. It's an issue that supporters have been pushing for a number of years. And next week, there will be a public hearing on the issue. In the past, supporters of the ordinance have been on this program, but not everybody is in love with it. So today, we will hear from an opponent. Former Mayor Mike Reed is the co-owner of Poplar Wine and Spirits in Casper that includes an adjoining smoke-free bar. Reed says the smoke-free approach has worked well.
There's people that are looking for no smoking establishments, and we have a couple outside patios, and one of those is reserved for smoking, but none inside the building.
So I'm assuming your opposition to this ordinance probably has the fact that you saw yourself as doing something unique and you didn't necessarily need the playing field leveled?
Well, and that's part of it. I mean, as a business owner, you try and develop a niche, and there were a few of us that developed that niche in the bar business, and that's part of my issue with it. The other part of it is, I mean, we're doing what is right, and that is everybody is starting to be non-smoking, but it's their choice.
And why is that, so important that it's a choice issue?
You know, to me, it's my business. I'm the one who's taken all the risks. I should be able to set what happens in my building. Just like I have a dress code in my bar. That's my choice. And the city or the state or the federal government shouldn't come along and say, this is what you have to do. We put up with enough of that to begin with.
As you look at this from an economic development standpoint, if you put that hat on, can you see that the city council might have a good point in trying to get, I guess, more people to go out and about in Casper if it was smoke-free? Is there a point there to be made at all?
No, I don't think so. I think basically what you do is you do the opposite of that. You hurt businesses who do cater to smokers. And let's face it, smokers are people who are good people. It's just that they choose to make that decision to smoke. They should have some place to go if they want to that makes it so they can smoke and they can enjoy themselves.
Now, explain this ordinance to me. Can you smoke outside of an establishment? Is that a problem at all?
You can smoke outside of an establishment, but you have to be 10 foot away from the door. And where that comes into an issue, if you're a downtown bar, people can't even basically walk by your place smoking because it's not 10 feet away from the door. That's the extreme of it. In my case, I have an outside patio that's within 10 feet of the door. That patio can't be moved, so it's going to have to become non-smoking. It's just ridiculous.
Is there a health discussion, though, to be had here at all, Mike? I mean, you have bartenders, you have people that are servers and that sort of thing. When it came up in Laramie, this was a big topic of discussion. Should people who want a great job at a bar where you're going to make a lot of money, you know, have to also be forced to be in a smoking area? I mean, why isn't that maybe something that the city council should be considering here?
You know, I think that's something that's a valid point. I do believe that there's a health issue. But if you don't want to work in a smoking area, you can go find a job in non-smoking areas. In Casper, the majority of restaurants are non-smoking, and I think about 68 or 70% of the bars are non-smoking, and they're good bars. So you can get a job. If you're a good bartender or a good cocktail waitress, you can make money in a non-smoking bar or a smoking bar.
As you look ahead, how do you see this thing playing out?
I think that they've got the push and they've got enough people convinced that it's a health issue that they're going to go ahead and go with it. While I agree there are some health issues, it's not a total health issue. This is an issue of we don't want people to smoke, so we're just going to shove it down their throats.
The last time Casper did something, I guess, similar to this, there was a referendum and it got overturned. I'm correct about that?
Yes.
Yeah. What would you think would happen if that goes to a vote again, which I assume it probably will?
I would believe it would be overturned again. I believe that there's enough people out there smoking that that they can muster enough support to do this, not only just because of smoking, but just because of the freedom of choice. So business owners get it. They're going to do what's best for their business, but people who want to smoke and business owners who want them to smoke in their establishments should be able to make that choice.
Thanks to Mike Reed of Poplar Wine and Spirits, the Casper City Council will hold a public hearing on the smoke-free ordinance Tuesday night. Changing gears, we tend to think about scanning and printing as something that you do with pieces of paper, two-dimensional objects. But now, a geological museum in Wyoming is scanning and printing things in 3D. They're using 3D scanners and printers to make plastic replicas of dinosaur bones and other fossils, which can help with research and make collections accessible to scientists and museum goers around the world. Willow Belden went to Casper and filed this report.
Attached to Casper's Tate Geological Museum are a series of dusty back rooms. Triceratops bones are laid out on a high table. Smaller specimens line the shelves. Researchers chisel away at fossils they've unearthed, trying to learn about the history of the specimens and get them ready to put out on display. Today, there's an additional project going on here, 3D scanning of a small fossil. J.P. Cavagelli is the Tate's field operations specialist. He brings out the specimen they're working on today. It's about a foot long and consists of a long backbone and an angular skull. The creature is a triathic nothosaur.
Which is not a dinosaur. It's a marine reptile related to plesiosaurs, which in common everyday language is Loch Ness Monster. What we're looking at here is, that's the skull right there. It's a little crushed, but you can see the line of teeth here. These are actually his eye holes, and a string of vertebrae coming through here.
Cavagelli sets the fossil on a table, and Stephen Cowley, who's doing the 3D scanning, starts setting up his equipment. It's pretty simple, really. He's got a laptop with special software, a digital camera, a projector, and a whiteboard with a series of black dots and circles. He sets the fossil in front of the whiteboard and positions his camera and projector just so.
It works off of the same principles of stereoscopic vision. So one eye is the camera, one eye is the projector.
By focusing both on the same spot, you can create a 3D image of something. Cowley turns on the projector and a beam of light falls across the fossil. Then he goes to work on his computer.
So now it's kind of calibrating itself, or we're getting basic reading?
Yep, so now we're determining where our left eye is.
Okay.
And now we're good.
When Cowley is done scanning the fossil, he'll have a 3D digital image of the specimen on his computer. Then the museum can use a 3D printer to create a plastic replica of the fossil. That's useful because this is the only triathic nothosaur skeleton in North America. So when they send the real thing back to the Geological Museum in Laramie, they can put the copy on display in Casper. Creating replicas of fossils isn't new, but traditionally it's been done by making silicone casts, and that can be dangerous with delicate specimens. The nothosaur, for example, has teeth that are only half a centimeter long, and the gaps in between are tiny.
And if you start filling those little gaps with silicone, as soon as you pull the silicone off, you would break the teeth off.
Cavagelli says silicone can also discolor some specimens, so it's safer to make the replicas with a 3D scanner. Plus, it has the potential to make life easier for researchers.
So that if Dr. So-and-so in Tokyo wants to look at a specimen from Wyoming, he's like, get on the computer, send him a 3D scan. He can look at it, rotate it in a screen, and
print it
if he wanted to, yep. It's a lot easier and maybe cheaper than sending a specimen to Japan.
Wyoming's museums aren't alone in their efforts to start making digital replicas. The Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. is embarking on a project to scan part of its massive collection of fossils and sculptures, and other institutions are following suit as well. Nick Pineson is a paleontologist at the Smithsonian. His team did 3D scans of whale fossils in South America, and he says for giant specimens like whales and dinosaurs, being able to create smaller but still accurate replicas is an excellent research tool.
All of a sudden, you can actually handle and manipulate something that would have been impossible to do otherwise. All of a sudden, you're able to perceive the entire skeleton in one glimpse, and then you can compare it to other skeletons right next to it. That kind of comparative work is really the gold standard.
3D scanning is also helping scientists piece together history. When they discover a new specimen, they can scan the material around that specimen. That allows them to analyze things like the angle at which plants were deposited in the area. The Tate Museum in Casper is doing that kind of scanning with the T-Rex they recently unearthed in Wyoming, and it's helped them to determine that the dinosaur probably died in a flood. Aside from the specific things researchers can learn from 3D scans, there's general agreement that the technology has a democratizing effect on science. Again, Nick Pineson at the Smithsonian.
Data become freely available online. A lot more people can learn about natural history that may not be in their backyard. So I think that opens the door, research-wise, to a lot more people contributing and asking scientific questions. So I really think that this kind of digital technology is really going to be a boon to everybody.
Of course, all this emphasis on duplication doesn't mean original fossils aren't important, too. Still, most agree that scanning, sharing, and replicating collections is going to be the future for natural history museums. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Coming up, Governor Matt Mead discusses budget cutting and a number of issues, and we'll look at ozone in Pinedale, and Tristan Autone reports on uranium water contamination. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. We are now joined by Wyoming Governor Matt Mead. We recently spoke to the governor in his office about a number of topics, including proposed state budget cuts. One of the things I heard very recently from some in the mining industry is they wondered how sustainable these gas prices are. As you think about it and you look about it, are we just being very proactive here, or do you suspect that the gas prices probably will turn around?
Well, I think they'll turn around. I mean, natural gas is a great fuel source, and as we see the technology that allows us to produce more and more of it, it'll turn around. I think the big question and the difficult thing in terms of a policy is, when is it going to turn around? Some people say, don't cut. Let's go ahead and dip into savings. Well, if I knew this was a six-month deal, that may be one thing. But if you dip in now and this is a five-year problem, you won't be able to sustain that. So I think they'll come back. We just don't know when. I heard a report recently that they may go, we may see gas below $0 and that people will be paying people to take gas off their hands this summer. And so I'm trying to be as proactive as possible with the agency saying, let's look at 8%. Part of that hopefully doesn't come about, but we don't want to be faced, right a month before a legislative session and the legislature say, hey, everybody cut 10%, because they can't do it as well then. And they're going to be chopping off the top rather than the precision that is required to do it in a way that we don't hurt programs or the citizens in an inappropriate way. So this is as pre-planning as you can get on this, but I think it's the right way to go.
I assume you've thought a lot about this. What's going to be your criteria when you agree with a cut and or maybe disagree? What's some of the things you're going to be looking at?
Well, the process is I've asked every agency to prepare this 8%, and then I'm going to be in this difficult position of saying, no, that's too deep, or maybe that's not deep enough. What we're going to look at is, what program is going to be hurt? Are we going to be losing any positions there, which I hope doesn't happen? But my criteria is going to be, first and foremost, we want to sustain the services we have now as best as we can. But we're going to all have to cut back. This office and every other office is going to have to cut back on such things perhaps as travel and conferences, all those sorts of things. And then I think the state has to be, aware that this could be more than a six-month or even a couple-year deal, and we have to be proactive with the legislature this next session, too, in the supplemental budget.
You've talked about let's do the cuts first and then maybe see if we need any more revenue sources. But are revenue sources part of this big picture as you look ahead?
Well, I think that, you probably saw this ALEC report last year. And one of the things, they have this Laffer curve where they say those states that have increased taxes, sort of counterintuitive, have seen decrease in revenues because they've run off businesses. So I think we have some, recognizing the state budget more than doubled over the last decade, I think this is the right way to go first. Can we take 8% trim? Remember, in 1 year, Friedenthal had asked for 10% cuts, and that was pretty shocking, I think, to the agencies. So these agencies, I think, have experience doing this. So we'll first take a look at the cuts, and then when you talk about additional revenue, you know, are you going to get additional revenue if you raise taxes? And I just don't want to head down that road now.
Governor Matt Mead visiting with us today. A couple of questions I want to ask you about that are out there in the state that people are talking about. One is your proposal just the other day on a CO2 pipeline. What are you proposing there, and what would that do for us?
Well, we already have a CO2 pipeline project that's being done by Denbury now. What we're trying to do is, as we have, whether it's CO2 or natural gas, we want to have the process as streamlined as possible. And these corridors, you know, gas line port corridors, we ought to have some proactive thought in that, where they're going to go, where they already exist, the mapping that's involved in that. Because what we want to do is, if a company wants to come in, we want to say, listen, we've already mapped out where the sensitive areas are, where we don't want to go because wildlife or whatever it may be, but here's the area where you can go. Here's where the assets are. Here's where the enhanced oil recovery is going to take place, and we've already got corridors mapped out to make it as easy as possible and to avoid the long delay that's associated in working through the rules and the regulations and wildlife areas and environmentally sensitive areas.
I want to ask you about electricity and the whole transmission effort. I know the BLM is in the process of wrapping up some of that work. Do we have somewhere to put this electricity or send this electricity?
Well, we think we do. On any one of these projects, some of these wind projects, of course, they're working with a number of states, including California, and Governor Brown and I are still trying to get together. I mean, we have, on renewables, we have great opportunity, but we also have great opportunity, you know, on natural gas turbines as well in the state. But there is a need for electricity, and you talk to Rocky Mountain, you talk to other utility companies, you know, it's going to happen. So I do think there is a demand. The question is, you know, which state and how much demand.
Is the whole wind issue slowing down? I know there's a little concern out there about the federal energy tax credit that's out there, but I you don't hear as much about it as we once did, and I'm just wondering what your view on it is.
Well, it seems like there's a little bit of a cooling off period, and I think some of that has to do with, as I talk to wind companies, they're still not satisfied with the tax climate in Wyoming. We didn't solve that last session, and I was hoping that we would. We're going to take another run at it this session to try to have a tax policy that provides what it should to the counties, to the locals, and to the state, but at the same time is not prohibitive. And right now we have a huge upfront sales tax for these wind companies, which makes it very iffy as to financing. And I proposed even during the campaign, you know, we ought to be looking at the generation tax. That is part of the picture now, but I think that is the better funding model and taxation model, both from the company standpoint and, frankly, from the county standpoint, the future.
Bouncing some questions around with Governor Matt Mead, I want to ask you another question. This one comes from the Twitter universe, Governor, involving the roadless rule, something that the state has been very active in challenging. There's some discussion that you're looking at a state roadless rule. What's your strategy and what are you thinking there?
We continued that lawsuit because we don't want to be left in a position where we have no options. But I think the thing we need to be doing now as a state is working with the Forest Service and seeing if we can collectively come up with a plan. And we've already begun that process because it's a big issue. I mean, and it's, you know, you have people on both sides, but I don't think it's ultimately going to be resolved in the courts. I think hopefully it will be resolved with us working with the Forest Service and trying to figure out what we should do in the state. Part of that is just an inventory. What do we have, and then what does it mean? Because there's, you know, roadless rule means different things to different people, including members of the Forest Service. So we've got a ways to go on that, but until we can get it resolved, we needed, in my mind, to protect ourselves legally.
So what is your read? What is your, as you talk to forest officials, what are you concerned about? I guess why are you worried about this?
Well, I'm worried on multiple use. I mean, how is it going to affect multiple use? How is it going to affect their ability to address issues like pine beetle kill? Are they going to be able to remove trees? Or are they going to shut down things that we don't even know about? Where is it going to be, and how is it defined? And particularly, it's important, I think, to the counties. You know, they want to know what's going on into the future and what ability they may have for timber industry or for minerals. And it's a difficult question because we also recognize there's obviously places, you know, that we say, you know, this isn't a place we want any development. But does that mean you can't have a road there in order to address just management of the area? As we see beetle kill around the state, you know, that's forest management's a big deal outside of other industries.
Governor Matt Mead, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me on again.
It's official now. The Environmental Protection Agency says Sublette County and parts of neighboring counties are violating federal air quality standards because ozone levels have gone above the legal limit multiple times in the past few years. It's widely recognized that the problem stems from emissions in the oil and gas industry. When you get the right combination of two types of emissions, NOx and VOCs, coupled with certain wintertime weather conditions, ground-level ozone forms. Ground-level ozone is the main component of smog and can cause respiratory problems. Residents and state officials have known about the problem for several years, but now the federal government is stepping in. The EPA is designating Sublette County a non-attainment area, which means Wyoming will be obligated to fix the problem. Steve Dietrich, the air quality administrator at the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, says the non-attainment designation means the clock is ticking.
Once the designation is final, we have 3 years from that date to become attainment for the ozone standard.
Exactly how that will happen is still up in the air. The EPA will set certain requirements that Wyoming will have to follow, but we don't know what those will be because the EPA is in the process of updating them. Dietrich says if past requirements are any indication, there are a number of things the state will have to do.
There will be emissions inventories that have to be submitted. Emissions inventory of any source out there of emissions, which is something we are already doing.
Plus, Wyoming may start requiring drilling companies to use the cleanest technologies available on new equipment and facilities, and may call for older facilities to be upgraded in order to lower emissions. Dietrich notes that the state has already taken some measures to curb ozone-causing emissions.
We have an offset program that's been in place since 2008, and what that is all about is any new facility coming in has to offset VOC and NOx emissions that they're going to create with this new project. The idea being that even though new production is being allowed to happen in a non-attainment area, you're not creating additional NOx and VOCs above what we saw back in 2008.
Plus, DEQ has been encouraging industry to take voluntary measures to curb their emissions on days where ozone levels are expected to spike. Dietrich says many companies that are drilling in the area have agreed to come up with ozone contingency plans, which are measures they can take on any given day to reduce short-term emissions.
It may be that certain maintenance operations will be curtailed. It may be that they reduce truck traffic to and from a facility that's just being worked on, or anything they can curtail and delay from a normal operation standpoint to when we're not in an ozone action day is what they try to do.
Dietrich says the state plans to continue with these measures, but the formation of wintertime ground-level ozone is a rare and complex occurrence, and DEQ hasn't figured out how much you'd have to reduce emissions in order to solve the problem. Dietrich says if the state doesn't manage to come back into attainment within the allotted 3 years, they'll get more time, but they'll also have to put more stringent rules in place.
The contingency plans that I mentioned earlier that were voluntary with industry then become regulatory, and so everything gets ramped up and becomes, we move from voluntary to mandatory.
The DEQ has convened a task force composed of citizens, local leaders, and representatives from the energy industry. They'll make recommendations to the state about how to tackle the ozone problem, and then the DEQ and the governor will come up with a formal plan.
Last week, the Department of Energy announced that uranium at nearly twice the legal limit had been found in the tap water of four households on the Wind River Reservation. The event marks another incident in a long and troubled history in the area. Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Autone brings us this report on the find.
In 1963, the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill ceased operation on the Wind River Reservation. When it closed, it left behind nearly 2 million cubic yards of contaminated material, known as tailings, unlined in the open and subject to rain and snowfall for over 20 years. In 1988, the Department of Energy moved the contaminants to the Gas Hills and announced that the site would clean itself up after 100 years. But in 1998, the department returned to the reservation, telling residents that they shouldn't drink from their water wells for fear of contamination.
That's where we used to get all our water, is well water. This little house?
That's Yufna Soldier Wolf, an Arapaho tribal member living about a mile away from the old Susquehanna tailing site. She points to the now abandoned pump house on her family's property.
And we used to play in it. We used to just, like, that little ditch right there where little kids, and we used to just play in all that water right there.
Soldier Wolf's family was told not to drink their water around 1998, and the DOE eventually brought an alternative water supply to the area, plastic piping that runs from a clean source of water through the contaminated uranium plume to the Soldier Wolf's house and around 40 others. But not everyone got on it. Take the neighbor Kathy Soldier Wolf, Euphena's sister-in-law, for example. She finally got on the DOE's water supply last fall. Up until then, she used a well, the same instrument the DOE told people not to use. Walking into her home, she immediately shows off her washing machine, bathroom sink, and tub. They're all staying the color of rust after using the well water.
I call it kind of like a rusty red. That's what my hair used to be anyway.
Kathy Soldier Wolf is a blonde.
We ruined lots of clothing, and even near the end, if I did like blue clothes, you'd find patches of brown all through them, and all my Taekwondo clothes got ruined because they go browny yellow, and so we'd have to throw them out, or anything white, we'd always have to go into town. Even dark clothes was ruined.
Soldier Wolf says now with the DOE water supply, they can wash clothes in the house again and occasionally drink, but that may not be the same for everyone. On May 2nd, the Department of Energy announced that fall testing results showed levels of uranium in four household taps on the alternative water supply at nearly twice the legal limit. This week, new test results were released showing those same taps plus two more had well below the legal limit. However, the find does little to assuage fears in the community. Euphena Soldier Wolf says there is a problem in the area, especially with the DOE's pipe, and especially when it breaks. She explains what her water looks like when that happens.
It will look like you dipped your glass in, you know, the muddy little ponds that you get after it rains. That's how it would look if you got a cup of water. Like, we would run the shower, the bath for our kids. Sediment would come out of that, too, and just be in the tub or the shower.
Euphena says when there's a pipe break, it's hard to know if it's safe to use the water. She says most of the time the only way for residents to know there may be a problem is when they see workers out fixing or flushing the system. Last year, we spoke with DOE officials after test results showed that uranium spikes had appeared in the area nearly 100 times the legal limit as a result of the 2010 floods. Here's the DOE's April Gill, manager of the site, talking about whether breaks could allow contaminated groundwater and sediment to get into the pipe and eventually in people's taps. Again, this is from last fall.
So I have talked to the lead engineer out there, Jerry Redman, and he says that this is not an issue. That essentially, water doesn't flow uphill. And I know people are very concerned about that, but we don't believe it's a real serious technical problem.
So I found Jerry Redman, the director of the Northern Arapaho Utility Program, and I asked him about the issue.
Anytime you get a break in the line, there's always a potential for contamination to enter into the water system. You always have to flush the lines after a break.
And when there's a break and a flushing, how do people know about it and take precautions? They don't.
When you got 400 customers and, say, 20 customers are affected, you know, to drive to each home and just tell them, you know, don't drink your water until we let you know again. You could say the radio and people can say, well, we didn't listen to the radio. It's, well, we put it on. Other than just the radio station and, you know, hand deliver a notice.
On top of that, Redman says when there's a break, Northern Arapaho utilities have to get the water tested for chloroform or other contaminants before giving residents the okay to drink.
You can't just say, hey, your water's safe to drink, go ahead and drink it. You have to have the lab verify it. You know, it could take 2 to 4 days, you know.
In 2005, a report commissioned by the DOE found contaminants in the form of radionuclides in the alternative water supply. And that same report concluded that contamination was most likely due to stale and stagnant areas of the system or biofilm capturing and concentrating radionuclides. The final conclusion, flush the system every 6 months, and if that doesn't work, physically remove stagnant water and biofilm with a robot. Neither Northern Arapaho Utilities or the DOE could confirm if any of these protocols had been adopted. Again, here's Euphena Soldier Wolf.
All we want is clean water. You know, is that possible? You know, are we going to be able to even get that? A lot of finger pointing goes around, but really nobody wants to take responsibility for it and be accountable for what's happened. So
the Department of Energy refused to talk to us about this in person and did not return additional requests for follow-up interviews in time for this story. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tristan Ottone.
Coming up, we talk with Laramie author Allison Hagee about her latest book, and Laramie writer Tiffany Holmquist Bishop gets us ready for Mother's Day by discussing how motherhood has changed her. This is Open Spaces.
And finally, Many young mothers may have a general idea of how motherhood will go, and in many instances they realize later that those hopes and dreams have vanished. As Laramie writer Tiffany Holmquist Bishop explains, having two little ones can lead to changes.
Before I had children, I thought I had it all figured out. I'd roll my eyes at mothers in the grocery store who couldn't seem to keep their kids in the cart and out of the aisles. Or I would cringe when the host of a restaurant would seat a family with an insane toddler near my table. I mean the audacity of some people to think that they have the right to bring their children into a public place and let them act like, well, children. I remember thinking, when I have kids, things will be different. They will sit quietly in the cart at the grocery store and refrain from asking for things that are not on the shopping list. If I take my kids to a restaurant, they will, once again, sit quietly, eat what they ordered, and never spill their drinks. As most parents already know, the fantasy of sophisticated parents with sophisticated minions for children is just that, a fantasy. I believe Bill Cosby said it best in a stand-up routine almost 30 years ago when he said, "My wife and I were intellectuals before we had children. We were very, very bright people. Before I had children, I considered myself an intellectual. Now I find myself saying things that I never thought I would say as an intellectual or even as a parent. Things like, here, just wipe your nose on mommy's sleeve. Does anyone mind if I keep my breast milk in the office freezer? Please put some panties on before you play in the mud. Don't pee in the bath. That's yucky. Oh, don't drink the bath water. That's really yucky. Hurry, hold him down while I suck out the boogers. Does his penis look normal to you? Can you show me how to work Daddy's iPad? Why don't you go dance for your brother? He's feeling a little lonely. I'm sorry, officer. I really don't know how my six-month-old managed to dial 911, but I assure you, we are all safe in the Bishop House. So, if you find yourself making senseless declarations in front of random strangers, or maybe you can't go to the bathroom without a full-scale interrogation by a four-year-old, if the smell of spit-up brings back the most precious memories, and you still wake to the tiniest little whimper or cough, if mommy is the sweetest word you have ever heard in the whole world, then here's to you, and happy Mother's Day. I'm Tiffany Bishop.